Welcome back, everybody, and welcome to our television audience. Now is the opportunity for questions, and because we have a very large crowd and we want as many people to participate as possible, we want you to, when you go to the microphone, there's a microphone at the center there. Gordon Campbell is the referee, and we want you to state your name and make your comment and or question. Make it short, because as I said, we want as many people to participate as possible, and speak clearly so that General Dallaire can translate from his 18th century French into English, and then, I know, I'm just kidding. But he wants to be able to hear clearly and understand your question. So the floor is now open for questions, okay?
I can start. Hello, my name is Sibylla Manischmidt. I'm from Pincher Creek. I'm here because I just came back from working in Afghanistan, and I'm going to go back in 3 weeks. I work in Afghanistan with an international non-governmental organization called Medica Mondiale. And we work particularly with women and girls and boys who have been affected through sexualized violence through the years of war, and which are 24 years in Afghanistan. I came here because I'm very interested to hear your comments on Afghanistan, and I'd hoped you would speak about that and also about our changed roles there. As we all know now, soldiers have been hurt, and Glenn Berry has unfortunately been killed in Kandahar, and the role of, as I see it, and I'm only a civilian, but as I've seen it over the last year, of the Canadian Army in Afghanistan has changed. And I have big problems with that, but I'd just like you to comment on that, if Afghanistan fits in your idea in one of these two models you presented. And where are we going with this in terms of Canada being now the cleanup agent for the Americans in Kandahar? Thank you.
What a neat way of setting up the question, isn't it? The other reason why I need you to pronounce clearly and speak loud is I'm an artillery officer, so my ears are probably not to scratch either. In the Afghanistan situation, and I would contend that we're into this new era. When the Cold War ended, the era of classic wars that we knew for centuries, that culminated in World War II, and then ultimately in the Cold War, although we never fought, was laid out in the same fashion, where you have massive millions of people in uniform facing each other with all kinds of technology and a line in the sand, and someone, the politicians, try to keep a sort of security umbrella or balance in that. And then at one time or another, they fail, and then they turn to generals and they say, take our youth and go and fight and win. And as Patton explained, and those of you who might have seen his movie with George C. Scott, and George C. Scott stands there in front of a big American flag with all his bells and whistles, and he says, the aim is to have the other poor bastard die for his country. Well, that is classic warfare. That's where big armies face big armies in attrition and so on. But that disappeared with the end of the Cold War. For right now, the other poor bastard who's dying for his country is probably a suicide bomber, and he's taking you with him. And the big armies don't exist anymore. They're integrated into society. They're part of societies. And so you had the Gulf War for a couple of weeks. You had the American-led coalition for, again, a couple of weeks against the Iraqi army, an identified army in the field, and that's it. The killing and the employment of force is still there by non-classic threats. And the question is how do you create an atmosphere of security in those countries in order to permit the moderates to take a reasonable stance in a sense of security for them and their families, to bring in systems of governance, human rights, rule of law, and so on. And so the era of peacekeeping is over. We're not into that. And even when we did it, ladies and gentlemen, the Canadians, when we were doing it in the Cold War, it was about 3-4% of the work we were doing. 95% was preparing for World War III. However, that 3 or 4% in the eyes of Canadians provided enormous dividends, and it was the right thing to do in the context of those days when countries went at each other. But today, we're into conflict resolution. We're into enormous complexities where you have humanitarian, political, diplomatic, security, police, nation building, all wrapped in to attempting to bring solutions to these complex problems. And we're all functioning in ambiguity, not in clarity. And so the 90s, up until still today, is an era in which the leaders didn't really lead or anticipate what was going on. We far more reacted and did on-job training and stumbled into problems and did a lot of crisis management. And so the tool that's out there today in Afghanistan is far from being the effective supremo tool. That is how we're bringing the military with the concept of bringing security, how we're integrating the political and the nation building and the humanitarian together. It's not the answer yet. And the problem is that we've not done a lot of research for this new era. We are doing a lot of on-job training. And in so doing, I feel that we're either overshooting or undershooting or not doing anything at all. So the PRT concept, the fact that our troops are now fighting overtly in trying to establish security, is part of a process in which we are trying to find the solutions of bringing an atmosphere of security in those nations to permit them to, with a certain level of serenity, to reconstitute themselves under their rule of law and the adaptation of their democratic processes.
Mm-hmm. But we did that in the beginning with the ISAF force, and now we've moved into Kandahar to have, I think, a very different role.
It is part of the overall solutioning of Afghanistan. In the Sudan, we could have troops doing nearly classic peacekeeping in Darfur, or southern Sudan, and we can have them ultimately maybe having to fight in eastern Sudan because of a different problem. And so the nature of conflict is such that we require a whole new conceptual base of how to solve it. My research is in that. Let me give you a fast example. For 30 years I was in NATO and classic war. And so we had a lexicon. In the army, the military, we have lexicons of action verbs. To attack, defend, withdraw, bypass. And we all knew exactly what that meant. Even the Russians knew what it meant. And then in 1993, I end up in Rwanda, and my mandate is establish an atmosphere of security. What does establish mean? Does it mean that I defend that country when I'm demobilizing both armies against somebody else who's invading? Does it mean I watch them demobilize? To what extent do I commit my troops in the security situation there? And what is an atmosphere of security? No weapons at all in the country? Better control? Police state? And so we entered into an era of ambiguity that is not clear. And so when someone says, well, what is our exit strategy for Afghanistan? I don't know, 20 years? 30 years? What is our exit strategy for Haiti? We pulled out of there way too fast. And look at the mess that started off again. And so we're into long-term, complex, ambiguous situations, and we must stop trying to impose impossible milestones on those people. I had to take a country that had a century of oppression under colonial rule, had then a dictator for 30 years, then a 3-year civil war, and I was to take it in 2 years to a democratic election. And it never had a multi-party system. Now, we are creating many of those scenarios. Thank you, madame. And that's my short answer, I'm afraid, on that one.
Hi, Mr. Romeo Delair. Thank you. I would just like to thank you for that amazing, insightful, and inspiring speech there. My name is Kiara Stella Cruz, and I'm from the University of Lethbridge. I'm also a citizen of Canada and a citizen of this world, so I feel I have the responsibility to preserve humanity, and also I have the duty to help those who are in dire need of help. I think the question that I would like to ask you now is, and I think it's the question that is in all of our minds, is what can we do? Mm. You know, I'm a third-year anthropology major, and I have no desire of going into politics. So, and it's too late for me by that point, and I, therefore I don't have, I'm not in any position to affect change. And so I was wondering, what can we do to affect change? And I should also add right now is, I'm also a representative of the Amnesty International Club at the University of Lethbridge, but is that enough?
Well, there you go. I think the first thing, if I may, and to the little side comment you made, is that you will never have democracy if you have no politicians. And to continue to berate the political case of our country, the political dimension of our country, is to undermine the evolution of our democratic process. And so, as such, the political dimension of the nation should be something that people want to strive to bring the best skills to, for it is the guarantor, ultimately, of the democracy. Now, the other side is what to do. In when we look at the international community and how it's been responding since the end of the Cold War, one could say that it's been quite ineffective. It's either gone into places and done too much or not enough or not gone to places. And it certainly has not evolved to the state of preventing these catastrophes like it could have in Rwanda and so on if we'd gone in earlier. It's barely responding when the crisis is ongoing, and we tend to like to throw cash at the problem to sort of do a Pontius Pilate afterwards with the nation when we feel we can do that. And so, in my opinion, there are two components, I think, to the future and how to get involved. The first one is that we continue to strive to make the UN effective. And not just the UN in regards to UNESCO, UNICEF, and so many other things that the UN does, but in its role as the guarantor of human rights and peace in the world. And in so doing, I would recommend that we, one, hope to pursue the 100 and odd recommendations that Kofi Annan brought in to reform the UN. For the UN is the only impartial and transparent world body in the world. And no single nation-led coalition will ever have that transparency. It is dominated, these coalitions, by self-interest, and in there somewhere, yeah. And even if they ever evolve in the near term to making humanitarianism the priority of involvement versus self-interest, there's still the stigma that they've got in regards to being world powers. And so the first thing is make the UN effective. And to do that, the reforms and continue to strive as we did with responsibility to protect. And two, offer it a lot more capability. Offer another option to the UN than just the big powers taking the decisions. Let me give you the example to that. We were absolutely, totally, completely right in not joining the Iraqi war. And the Prime Minister of the time did not need Parliament to take that decision. What inspired him would be worthy of study. But the decision was taken and it was backed. However, we absolutely failed the Iraqi people. Because once the Americans decided to conduct that operation outside of the UN, we knew the Iraqis are going to suffer, one way or another, because you've got big imperial powers who are going in there under questionable reasons. And so what we should have done, and some of us tried, what we should have done is said, okay, you, the American and British forces, you're going to take on the Iraqi army. That is a classic use of force. One army against another one. And that army, the Iraqi army, had become a rogue army anyways because their generals had been so implicated in the regime. So you go beat them. But don't go into Baghdad. Let us go in. Middle powers. The Japanese, the Canadians, the Germans, some other, the Indians. Let us go in under the UN. Maybe we wouldn't have created the catastrophic failure that had happened. Stay in overwatch. And so one of the greatest instruments of the future is trying to convince Canada to commit a lot more capabilities. And it's not just cash. Capabilities to the UN so the big powers who have the veto right, and will keep it, that they don't continuously feel that they've got to exercise it because they're the only game in town and the rest of us are but bit players who can't take that on. The second side of that is join the NGO community. The non-government organizations. It is my opinion that they have exploded in numbers, of course, over the last years, but they are very immature. They're all over the map, and some of them might be even a little dangerous. But they are believing fundamentally in human rights. And I believe that more brain power, more effort, more Canadian youth getting their boots dirty out there, smelling, tasting, touching, bringing that capability back, we'll be able to make the NGO community a supra power, a supra capability that will influence public opinion and governments into the future. And so the greatest tool that's out there now, I think, is the maturing the non-government organizations, and that will be the primary one until countries of the developed world decide to make international development not a residual after we've paid for everything else, but a mainstream effort. You will not be able to bring 80% of humanity to the minimum of human dimensions without making international development a mainstream with defense, health, education, and so on. And for those who are not keen on altruism, terrorism is a developed world problem. And terrorism is an expression of rage by the developing world. And we've seen it from the Muslim world. There's nothing preventing the African world to do the same. And the only way you can attenuate that rage is by going to the source. And the instrument to do it at the source is not just cash in international development, but brain power and support.
Thank you, Romeo. My name is David Lina. I'm a retired teacher in this area. I'd first of all like to thank you and congratulate you on your wonderful presentation. I also want to recognize my table companion, Michael. I don't know his last name. After your talk, we exchanged views about it, and I said to him, Michael, if you had an opportunity to ask Romeo a question, what would it be? And he thought for quite some time and said, I would like to know if Romeo would run as for the position of the leader of the Liberal Party in Canada. I'm sure this is not the first time you've had this question asked, but if it is, I'm very grateful to Michael.
Well, my wife won't let me. Please.
I'd first like to say it's very much an honor to speak to you, sir. And secondly, as I looked around this room, I had to stand outside because there were so many people. I couldn't even see you when you were first giving the first part of your speech. And when I finally got a chance to look in, I noticed there were far more, if I may say, gray heads than young faces in the crowd. And I've noticed in talking with my companions at the university that we are more obsessed by the young with really what's on television or what's for sale than we are with the problems of the world. Now, I try and take a different view, but part of the reason you were left as you were with the impossible task you had in Rwanda was because, and if I may quote, I believe the press secretary of the U.S. at the time, the phones didn't ring. Now, what would you suggest someone like myself or any of us could do to get the awareness out there, to make the young care again? Because we are the ones who are going to make the change in this new era, are we not?
I think that, as I was trying to indicate, is that there's an enormous responsibility on us of our generation regarding the future. And let me make it with a side example. We of this generation will be the first generation that will be held accountable by future generations on the state of how humans will live on this planet in the future. If they're walking around with oxygen masks 5 generations from now, they will turn to this generation as the first one who had the responsibility of looking at the environment and taking decisions. Because my dad, he was born in 1902. I mean, we burned oil at home, we burned trees, there was lots of fish. There seemed to be no identifiable limit that could be considered in his sort of life perspective. But we know different. And so we're at the start of a massive revolution in regards to how human beings and the planet work out the future. And what I discover is that in so doing, there is still nowhere near enough of youth involvement and youth commitment to, in fact, picking up the reins from us and moving the yardsticks of the environment. And so why is there still not enough? Why do we see no activism in our youth? In Quebec, they went 3 weeks on strike at universities and CEGEPs because of tuition. Their tuition is one-third what you pay here. I spoke last week at a college in the United States in a town called Walla Walla. A magnificent campus, about 2,000 students. $30,000 U.S. for a year to study there. Okay? Now, if Canadian youth are concerned, of course, about tuition, and so we should all be in part of that, there's no negating it. How is it we can't get them to become activists in society? I got no problem having them skip an afternoon of classes and parade down Main Street here in Lethbridge and go and talk to the mayor and say, what the hell are you doing to influence the MPs and the MLAs to get us off our butt and do something about such and such in the world? We don't see it. We don't see that. And I think the reason is that we've created a sort of amorphous scenario that doesn't call for them to be full of their energy and confidence. However, it's there. You talk to them, it's there. It's just, what is the trigger to do it? And that's why I'll come back, and I'll end with this. I'll come back to the fact that what is absolutely essential at this time in the history of this nation that came of age in the old era, that is the Cold War era and pre, through the battlefields and the economics and some of the innovative thinking, that we came of age or matured during that phase, we have now come of age in the global era. We are a big global player. And in that coming of age, we've got to take a massive, distinctive orientation to the nation. For the youth can't just keep as the thrust for their future, the ambitions, keeping the system going. There's just that much more out there because they're going to be submerged by the outside world. And so I would contend that if we can focus the country to a higher ideal, we can do a lot more in the country, and the youth will be far more participant. And it also will be a hell of a lot easier, as an example, for a prime minister who's working under a concept that this nation has a responsibility to humanity and is going to pay a price for that to advance the plight of humanity. It'll be a lot easier for him to stand in front of a spouse or parents of a soldier who's just been killed, or a diplomat like we buried a couple of weeks ago, and say that death was essential. It was essential because it's part of the grand scheme of this nation in its role in the world. And until you can do that, you're pretty hard-pressed to say that that death and those injuries are so required. Thanks.
Hi, I'd just like to ask, how much time is being spent militarily?
Give your name, please.
My name is David Green.
Hello.
And I'd just like to know how much time is being spent militarily to develop a plan so that we can act on our own instead of just being sent in to clean up American mistakes.
Oh, and that's very, very interesting. But let me throw the other side of that coin first, and then I'll come back to it. We all remember, of course, the 11th of September 2001, and of course, 3,000 Americans are deceased, and the world is mobilized against terrorism. A couple of years before, 800,000 died, nobody came, but so what? So we have the world mobilized, and on the 11th of September, the sense of insecurity comes with an enormous reaction, of course. On the 12th of September, the Americans knocked on the door and said, exactly what are you Canadians doing about security? And it seems to us you're not doing enough and that we're prepared to provide you all kinds of help. And we had, in the Canadian media and so on, this reaction of, who in the hell do they think they are? We're a sovereign state. They're not going to tell us what the hell security is in our own country. We can do that. However, up until 1964, Canada was a major player in capabilities, even if all our generals didn't sit at the right tables, in capabilities in the world. In 1964, a white paper came out and also a defense budget, and it essentially said, why are we spending all this money on defense? We got this big neighbor to the south here. And so, for the last 40-odd years, we have been doing an attrition exercise on defense with the concept of accepting a higher level of risk because we got a very strong neighbor. And then all of a sudden the neighbor comes in and says, hey, I need your help. What are you doing? And we are obfuscated. We're insulted that they're actually telling us what to do. Well, you can't have it both ways. And so I, however, would contend is that the triple D policy base, which is defense, diplomacy, and development, is a basis to reconstitute our diplomatic corps, our international development, and our defense structure to be able to present to the UN our own strategic focus and orientation. And so, nearly a week before we went to Afghanistan the first time, I presented a paper and met with the Minister of National Defense at the time and the Foreign Minister. And I said, listen, I know we're fighting terrorism. I know we must be participant in that. But at the same time that's going on, they're killing them by the thousands in the Congo. The UN has asked for a Canadian three-star general. It has asked for a Canadian headquarters. It's asked for thousands of Canadian troops. It's asked for Canadian diplomats and humanitarians. We know the languages. They speak English and French. We know the area. We have experience. 2,000 Canadian troops in the Congo would be the backbone of a UN mission that would stop that slaughter. Send them to the Congo. But we send them to Afghanistan. The problem is that we should have had the capability to go to Afghanistan and the Congo. And that's where we got.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
John Boris is my name. Sir, I would like to tell you that I have been a regular attender at these functions for many years since this person who started it was sitting right beside me here, Mr. Campbell. Mm. There's never been a crowd like this before.
Thank you.
I don't know if I said what my name was. I made
yes,
it to you.
Yes, of course.
you got a good one. Thank you.
You have a question.
Yes, and my question is this. The borders we have in this world today have all come out of the end of a gun barrel.
Hmm.
Am I right?
And
since that is what is keeping them there, what are we going to do and how are we going to catch such a circumstance that we can get something started that isn't associated with war, with power, but associated with Mother Teresa, with, peace. And so since we have, everything is always done on military lines. After all, Canada was, we're trying to hold it together, but it was settled on the basis of power. And maybe we should have some money spent, some effort put into something that's called a peace unit. Not a not an army, because we know what an army's supposed to do, but something new, something that people who have charisma like you, Esther, can maybe start and get it going and therefore be a success towards real peace.
Well, let me see. I think that, first of all, we're in an era of conflict resolution, not an era of global war. And we just stopped that one in 89. We have a nuclear threat that's bouncing around that is not insignificant. However, we're into an era of conflicts where areas, regions of the world, countries often artificially created by the colonial era, are now trying to constitute themselves with their internal problems that were, in fact, brought about by these arbitrary boundaries. However, if you look at 1919. You notice we're doing a bit more history than CNN. CNN's last week, but we're going a little farther than that. In 1919, at Versailles, there were three major powers. The Americans, the new ones, the British, the big one, and the French, which was there also. And then you had Italy. The Russians were in disarray. The Chinese and so on were not within the stage. When you look at the big powers today, you got the same three players. And then others who are working and maneuvering for different reasons. And so one would say, geez, we haven't moved much. We haven't evolved much. I would contend that, in fact, the evolution of the power structures has become complex and diffused. It hasn't been all wrested away from the big powers, except they cannot function with the autonomy that did exist at that time. They can be held accountable, and we can attrit some of the belligerent rhetoric and fashions that some of these big powers are using. I think one of the most devastatingly negative dimensions that Canada can do right now in the world is to keep crapping on the Americans. We should be the privileged country to go inside the entrails of that philosophy of the world and influence it, work with it, maneuver it, fiddle with it, and try to influence it. For it's a country that is torn apart philosophically, and it is a country, in French we say meurtri, that has been affected within its soul. And there is in its soul an element of fear that was not there before 9/11. Pearl Harbor is nothing compared to 9/11. There is in there all of a sudden a vulnerability that is eating away at them and creating stresses that the Europeans can't even start to understand and that we should be far more attuned to. And so that is one of our grand ambitions, is to try to maneuver and to permit that country to, in fact, evolve what we would hope in a more flexible fashion. In regards to the military, you know, the Canadian Army up until 1989, the Cold War, was an army that was essentially in garrison training for war. And we had troops in the forward areas in Germany because the war was Central Europe oriented. But essentially, we trained and prepared and equipped for a possible war. Today, that is not the Canadian Army. Today, since the Gulf War, we have an army that is continuously in the field, in theaters of war, in theaters of conflict, in the midst of horrific humanitarian catastrophes, that is hoping every now and again to be able to come back home to garrison, to lick its wounds, take care of its wounded, and go back out. And the role we are doing now is the purest of roles that could imagine, except defending the nation against an enemy threat. Because the missions are just. We're out there as a credible force, providing protection for others to be able to work in a certain atmosphere of security, to bring in the instruments of governance, the rule of law, and the stability they need to reconstitute their countries. And so there is a need for force out there because of the nature of the frictions that exist between the peoples. However, the greatest strength that we could have is not in actually using that force. It's in the threat of using that force. And so the more professional, the more capable, the more determined that these soldiers can be as an instrument of providing protection, the less they will have to use it. And ultimately, ladies and gentlemen, it is my belief that all these frictions that are of our differences, one day they will be overcome. It may take only a couple centuries. But one day, as we work at human rights, as we work at the respect, not the tolerance, I think that's the most pejorative term, pretentious term we can invent, respect of each other, we will get rid of the frictions of our differences. And millions will die yet, and there'll be enormous amounts of problems, but one day we will attrit that friction, and we will have what I believe humanity wants and human beings want. It is serenity.
I wonder if you would comment on who I think are the real superpowers in the world, the super players, and that would be the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization. I'm not sure that there will be any kind of economic security in Africa as long as trade barriers are being established by an unelected, unaccountable group.
Yes, you're right that the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank are massive players, and of course the whole global international domain is throwing all that into flux. However, I would contend that the sovereign states still have enormous amount of power, although the concept of the nation state is going to slowly attrit. The concept of sovereignty will not be an absolute anymore. Just look at responsibility to protect, look at NAFTA and things like that. But in this phase that we are in, I still think that the concept of international development by the consortium of developed nations as an entity can still break the back of the poverty and the pandemics that exist in the developing world. I still think that the political strength is there to do that. I honestly don't know how to predict any more than that. What I only fear is that the economics of the world seems to have a lot more guts and risk-taking strength than the political side. And that political will often lacks the depth of conviction of what should be done and fluctuates too much by the near-term, immediate headline type of concept. And so, as the last election has proven, we are near-term tactical fiddlers in the weeds, and there hasn't been a strategic thought. I think it's just scandalous the way they use the term strategy. Strategy is the realm of the generals for us in the old Greek way. But strategy is the realm of leaders and not managers.
Is it still there?
Yes.
Hi there, sir. My name is Andrew Farrow. I'm from the University of Lethbridge. And my question for you would be, what do you believe is the most important reform to be done in the UN in order to make it a more effective body for dealing with stuff such as Rwanda?
Well, in fact, a lot of the peacekeeping reforms have been done. The responsibility to protect is now the doctrine, so it's an instrument to hold the Security Council accountable more than the charter and doing something. There's a whole set of criteria to do that. I will say that fiddling with the Security Council and trying to get rid of the veto power is a waste of time. Those five big powers still exist. They created the UN and the veto so that they wouldn't go to war with each other, and that scenario has not yet, you know, changed enough to fiddle with that. The other side, I think, which is essential, is that the developed world has got to be prepared to pay the price of peace. Up until the end of the Cold War, there were only about 13, 14 countries that did peacekeeping. It was a rich man's business. You had to bring your own equipment. You had to be able to sustain yourself. And poor countries did not have the assets to do that. And so it was very much developed countries, Canada, Ireland, Scandinavians, Italy, the British, and so on. And that was the bulk of the peacekeeping. However, since the end of the Cold War, we've done a bit like the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, at first, all its sons, and they had large families, would go off to war to defend the empire and increase it and hold it. As jobs got a little better in Rome and the families got smaller, the son was too important to send off the war, so we hired somebody else to do it. And so what has happened with world peace and stability is that we've hired developing countries' armies to do it. And so the Bangladeshis and a number of other developing countries who don't have the skills, the equipment, or the training to do the job, are doing complex peacekeeping missions, and too often than not, they're failing. That, I think, is one of the major problems. And so that's why, right now with Darfur, Canada reinforcing the African Union troops and committing themselves, I hope, far more to building up that capacity in Africa as the first respondents, and then with the UN to come in, is important. And so that means that the developed countries may have to pay in blood, sweat, and tears to keep peace in the world, and in so doing, be able to build the capacity in those countries to self-sustain themselves.
Thank you.
Okay. One more?
Two more? Two more.
Okay, yep.
Thank you. I'm Christopher Smith, a social worker, and had some minor work with international social services, but primarily one of the questions I was very interested in was, you mentioned conflict resolution, and we've had some reference here to language, and then of course the meta process of language, the language within language, some of the confusion about terminology, the definitional disarray, the young people and analysis of paralysis not moving. I was just curious with the work or research that is being done in that realm of conflict resolution, what types of efforts we might apply to the war of words. I look at things from a philosophical construct and sometimes wonder, even with the youth, you know, whether, you know, we really know whether we're coming at things as just another, economic machine, or whether, you know, we can return to or maintain the acknowledgement of a living organism, a spiritual organism, as if it were, you know, that looks out for our people who are, you know, we are connected. We are, as you said, only 12-hour flights away, and, you know, things affect each other. It's the language that I was really interested in, what type of work is, you know, what we acknowledge. Sometimes your own opening comments, you know, you've got a mandate, but the mandate was confusing. What was it you're being told? Yeah. And so what are we doing to work on clarifying our own words?
Yeah, in fact, there's not enough study being done on what should be the new language of diplomacy in this complex and ambiguous era. And there is, some of us are doing some of that work. But it is rather interesting, however, languages and how that can create barriers, because the language has its culture, and
very short.
When I was writing my book, I decided to write it in English. However, so often I would have a French word or verb that was more effective in the phrase than the English one that I ultimately used. When I translated the book, I had the reverse scenario. And so you sort of wonder that if the grand leaderships of the world were multilingual, there are words in some languages that come from some cultures that explain things that other languages don't even have the concept of to bring solutions and so on. And so I see far more an ability of integrating the languages and evolving it in all its fashions, but closer to the cultures and not destroying the cultures behind them. Of course, it's interesting, when I got the Governor General's award for my book, I wrote it in English, and the chap who won the same award but in French, in his speech at the end said that he thanked me for having written my book in English.
This will be the last question.
Howard Forsyth, I like your 3 D's.
Yes, sir.
And there's an opening in the Caribbean and Latin America. The U.S. has bumbled Monroe Doctrine for 150 years.
Mm.
Bush was thrown out of Latin America. There's room for development and diplomacy there, for Canada to sneak in the back door. We should go in with women. Women are nurturers. Men are predators. Half of all our leadership worldwide should be women. How can we do these things the way you would see it?
And at the end of this, I expect a doctoral presentation from the University of Lethbridge. And first of all, if I may, we snuck into the Organization of American States. Joe Clark, all of a sudden, one day it appeared. And we became a member of the Organization of American States. However, it's rather interesting that we do so little north-south, and yet so many South American countries who are getting rid of the whole concept of dictatorships and so on have been coming to the Canadian military and so on. We've been heavily involved in the South. But that hasn't been an impetus for us to learn Spanish, yet it should. And I think it's absolutely essential that the Americas have a north-south communications, because there are a few places down there that are going to turn into some basket cases. And how are we actually looking at that? Haiti is being abandoned in its plight. And we've not brought good solutions there. We're not culturally aware enough of how we can assist. And we can be such an incredible counterpoint to the Americans in regards to assisting many of those countries. So you're absolutely right there. Secondly, that in many of the countries where conflicts exist, one of the questions that I'm often asked is, what about reconciliation? I mean, how do these people live with each other afterwards? And after looking at it and having been involved in a number of countries, particularly Africa over the last while, I've come to a personal conclusion. It's not unique, I don't think, but it's that reconciliation in those countries, which are so culturally male-dominated, will only happen, in my opinion, by empowerment of women and education of the children. And I'll end with the following. In the Canadian Senate, there is over 40% of women, and they are the driving thrusts in that Senate. And that Senate gives a whole different perspective to what these bills that are being punched through this politically combative scenario that you find in the House of Commons, and how many times we've sent the bills back to get them cleaned up and restructured to meet what the government or the people expect. And the only way we're able to do that is because in the Senate we are not at each other's throats because of our political colors. Thank you very much.
Bob, one of the recommendations of General Dallaire is to join a non-governmental organization. You have in front of you a little red sheet. Would you complete it and fill it out, and someone will take it at the door or put it on the table outside, and then we'll be able to follow through with emails and involve you one way or another. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gordon. Gordon was a Fuller brush salesman in a past life, so he's very good at this. Thank you very much, General Dallaire. That was wonderful, and we've just been so honored to have you here this afternoon, and I think all of us have had a good experience here, and it has made us think, and I'm sure it will continue, and you will have provoked some discussion and thought that will be ongoing, and we certainly appreciate that very much. So again, thank you very much.